Again,
blessings.
You sure you were paying attention? Being mindful? Good. Well, this is supposed to be a Dharma talk, but it's going to be more like a show and tell. Well, I'm going to introduce you to how to practice mindfulness or insight meditation in daily life without the sitting, without the silence, without closing your eyes, without the cushions. And we will be bringing the practice, actually they are from the Four Foundations of Mindfulness from Theravada tradition. But it's using a different approach in your daily life. For example, when you are arguing with your spouse, you can't say, or you're with your boss, you can't say, wait a minute, I'm going to sit on the cushion first before I reply. Right? You have to pay attention right there to your mind, right there how to reply, how to engage. And so the practice is all about how to use mindfulness or insight meditation in daily life without closing your eyes, without the cushion. So one of my students said, I like this because I don't have to take the cushion everywhere I go. Because you can take the practice everywhere. See? And so the first thing we're going to do, because this is only like 45 minutes, or about 40 minutes of talk, which usually we cover these practices over a period of 12 weeks at my center in Sebastopol. So I'm going to just give you a very brief overview of the fundamental practices that we use to train our students in daily life. And so it will be kind of just a very, very brief overview. I wish I can do more exercises with you, but I'll give you some. Okay, the first thing I'm going to talk about. Let me go back. I wasn't supposed to skip. That's my deck master sitting there. You see, this is what you did during the 35 minutes of sitting practice. That's you right in the middle. Sorry, it's only a blob. But and because of the silence and closing your eyes, there is created a buffer zone of silence around you. And so in the sitting model, your external stimuli are kept at bay, more or less, although you hear some coughing and, you know, people moving and so on, but it's not, nobody talking to you right in your face. You know, you don't have to pick up the telephone, you don't have to engage with anyone. And so your external stimuli is more or less kept at bay so that you can meditate and pay attention to whatever kind of meditation that you are practicing. Now, in daily life, you don't have the luxury of this zone of silence. And that's what we will show you here. You see the... He just did it today. So you have the external stimuli coming to you through your five senses, as well as your sixth sense, which in Buddhism is your own thoughts and emotions and your fantasies, your, you know, anxieties, your fears, etc., all your stories. Now, we're going to consider how we are going to practice without this buffer zone. There you go. That's why I said it's show and tell. So here you see that I'm going to see if I can. So I'm going to see, I'd like you to focus on this point. Roger, oh, what's happened? If I'm, Roger, on the pad, oh, sorry. It's my fault. Here, we're going to focus on this point here, which is the, how do I know where it comes in? Oh, sorry. I'm still new at this, you see. Yeah, we're going to focus on this point of contact between the external stimuli and your senses, ears, you know, nose, olfactory senses, your hearing senses, touch, taste, everything else that you are in touch with during your waking hours. And the response to the external stimuli is what you're going to focus on, how you mentally or verbally or physically respond to the stimuli that is impinging on all your senses, all right? So you don't have this buffer. So how do we do this? And the next slide is going to be an expansion of this moment, right? Which is your reaction through your six senses. And please pay attention because I don't want you to miss out the next slide. Because if I try to go back, I'm going to mess it up. So don't blame me if you miss the next slide. Okay, just pay attention. So this little spark is going to be expanded into this. All right? Now that is the little spark. I told you I wasn't going to go back. Because I won't be able to bring it up again. So it was, if I have to sort of go back to, there was this little spark, you remember, on the other slide? Yeah. Now this is expanded to become like this. Looks like a jasmine, isn't it? Whatever. You're going to have a lot of fun with me. But please take away something, you know, just not the fun. Yeah. So it's going to be, this is expanding what happens in the mind in this way. And we call this the cycle of conditioning or suffering. Now, let me erase this. So that little spark in your mind, through contact with the five senses or the sixth sense, which is the mind avenue, so this is the contact point that we're going to elaborate.
What does that say?
Pardon?
Contact.
Oh. Just contact, C-O-N-T-A-C-T. Sorry, I can't zoom that for you. Okay. The next one is consciousness, which, consciousness, you know what it is, right? Yeah. If you don't have that, you won't be here anyway. Sorry. It means you're seeing the screen. So in Buddhism, we call that eye consciousness, you're hearing my voice, that's hearing consciousness. And at this level, there is no discrimination as yet. It is pure seeing, pure hearing. There's not even discrimination of what it is. Like, for example, you get up early in the morning, you know, you don't even know where you are, right? Doesn't it happen sometimes? Yeah, and that's where the seeing consciousness is, before discrimination enters the mind. And it happens very fast, and in daily life, actually, you cannot discern that unless your practice has matured so well. Okay, so very quickly, what will happen is it will move on to a discrimination of the object, which is the through your sensations. Okay, like For example, you're listening to my voice. Is it pleasant or unpleasant or neutral?
Neutral.
Okay.
That's
pleasant.
We all love you.
I won't abandon you, even if you say unpleasant. That's part of my practice. Oh, we'll come to clinging, don't worry. This is the part that is can be very strong, sometimes it can be very soft, depending on whatever. When you were sitting in silence just now, some of you were, I know, were uncomfortable, you were trying to move, you were trying to change. What was the sensation that you were feeling? Unpleasant, right? Disagreeable. So sensation is something that we cannot change. We cannot, you can change by moving yourself out there or putting on clothes, but right in the moment, you cannot delete sensations, because so long as you have your five senses are intact, you will have sensations. Even the enlightened will have sensations. The only thing is they won't be clinging to it. And so the way we classify or experience sensation is either through pleasant, unpleasantness, or neutral. Now, even that is impermanent. Don't you feel that when I first started coming here, I just could not like pizza? It was hard. Now I love it, without a lot of cheese, of course. Yeah. So it can change from unpleasant to pleasant, and it can also change from pleasant to unpleasant, or it can move either way, or to neutral. Okay, it can be. I'm sorry, Roger. This is not doing me much credit. What's that? Oh, yeah.
Just one more.
The Burmese have a saying, if you're not sure, always go back to the old way. That's what I'm doing. I'm going back to what I'm used to. So you see pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Even the sensations can change, right? And, you know, for example, my most graphic example is sometimes there are things that are pleasant to you when you really feel upbeat, but there are foods that will seem unpleasant to you when you're really sick, even the same kind of food, you know. So it's so conditional. That's why this is called the cycle of conditioning. Our reactions are so conditioned due to our internal as well as the external conditions. Now, we don't stop there. Through our sensations, we then move on very quickly to value judgments. Don't we do that? Just now somebody came and said, oh, I like the way you were conducting the sitting, the meditations. So that's a value judgment. But it's a good value judgment because he said he liked it. If somebody said, you know, oh, she did a lousy job, then it would be a negative value judgment. Right? Or somebody who said, what, neutral. Right? So it could be either any of these three. But they can, again, move back and forth, because neutral is not a permanent sensation. It's temporary, it's conditional, it can change any time. From liking, it can move to neutral. From disliking, it can move either way. You know, all this is, it can go round and round in circles. You know, one of my best example is, okay, two people meet when they were young, and they like each other so much they fall in love, and they get married. Okay. After 5 years, can't stand each other anymore. And so from liking, it moves to dislike. Okay. Another 2 years, get divorced. But after 20 years, you meet each other again, are now old and decrepit, and, you know, teeth falling like myself. And then you're just friends. You've forgotten all about the past. So you see how your liking and dislike, your value judgments, your feelings of liking, disliking, resentment, all these are impermanent, you know, like everything else in life. But we tend to think that they will always be permanent. That's why we think that somebody who loves us will always love us until death. But, well, whatever happens, happens, right? Yeah. And so from here, from value judgments now follows a huge series of emotions. From dislike, it can turn into resentment, and resentment can be repeated again and again, becomes clinging, and goes into anger, this whole hatred. You see, this is the same emotion, but it is intensified as it goes through the cycle. Now, with liking, it's the same thing. It can move to desire, desire into craving or clinging, to greed, to craving, obsession, etc. And if you're in that cycle once, you're done. This will repeat over and over and over again. It becomes a loop. Okay. That's why, you see, in Buddhist psychology, it says the thought moments occur billions of times in one flicker of an eyelid. So you go into one cycle of hatred or craving, you're gone. You know, you repeat over and over, unless you can break it, unless it is too mild, so mild that you don't, it doesn't stick with you. But generally, this is what happens. So that's why we call this a cycle of conditioning or suffering. Because from, if you look at on the left-hand side, these are very strong emotions, right? And these emotions like greed, anger, hatred, craving, they cause intense suffering. And then from these strong emotions, we usually burst out into speech, don't we? Before we know it, you're already, you know, it's through our mouth and into, you know, throwing something out. And then from then it also goes into our action, which can be very unwholesome. Even if you don't speak, you know, your facial expression, right? Your body language can say a lot. And all these are based on delusion, according to Buddha's teaching, of course. So the two, you see three tracks here, the greed, ill will, and then you have the other track, desire, clinging, etc., anger, etc. They are both, one is ill will, the other is greed. Okay. So it is within the delusive state that we traverse this, repeat the cycle over and over again until it's hard to break out of it. Okay. That becomes a habit for a lot of us. And then down here I had put in clinging or attachment. It happens at every stage. You can cling to pleasant, unpleasant. You can cling to your value judgments. You can cling to your likes, dislikes, resentment. At every stage, clinging can happen. Okay. That's why I put it down below. And so this is what the Buddha describes as how we suffer, how our experience in our life lead to our own emotional suffering or physical suffering, because emotions can also lead to physical ailments and so on. Now, am I quite clear about this?
Yes.
Okay. All right, because you have only 10 minutes for discussion at the end of the talk.
Yeah.
So, and I'll be only asking two people to discuss. Oh, that's what the evening is about. Yes, it is conditioned. It is conditioned. Now, the question is, how do you practice mindfulness in this kind of merry-go-round that's happening in your mind? Okay. Don't you want to know about that?
No.
Say yes. Okay, we have worked out 5 practices that we do to pay attention to the mind states that's happening during this kind of merry-go-round. The first practice that we focus on is to break through this cycle. You can ask, how do you break out of this cycle? The first practice we do to break out of this cycle is to watch our likes and dislikes. The second practice is to watch our value judgments. Third practice is to watch our attachment. This is the third practice. But we do have another 2 preliminary practices, which I'm not going to talk about it here because of the time factor. Now, you can ask, why is value judgment the second and not the first? It's because value judgment is very difficult to break a habit of. So watching your likes and dislikes is easier than, you know, dealing with value judgment. It's a softer state. It's, you know, it's easier to identify. It's easier to let go. Now, value judgments, I'll be explaining that, and clinging. These two are extremely difficult to practice on. And so we can exit in these 3 places. But also, it is possible, this is for beginning students. When we start to train our students, we use these softer states to train them in the skill of mindfulness in daily life. But as they progress, as their practice matures, they are able to cut through greed, they are able to cut through anger, hatred, etc. Of course, that comes later on. But most of our students would say, oh, it's quite an effort to stay just on the right-hand side of the cycle. Okay. They usually, you know, have gone to the left already. So this is also a working model for my students. You know, they, at first, when they get this, you know, handout, they stick it in their mirror, they stick it on their, you know, computer, whatever. So they use this to visualize the cycle and sometimes see where they could exit. So you can ask then, how do you work with likes and dislikes? Okay, can I have that? Yeah. Okay, now listen. Do you like the sound?
Yes.
Can you watch your mind liking the sound? Now, don't focus on the ones you have heard the sound, leave the sound and go directly to your mind and see that liking process going on in your mind. Don't close your eyes. Can you see your liking mind? Can you? No? Forget the noise, forget the sound. Can you? Is your liking still going on?
My liking stopped.
With a stopping of the... Okay. Okay, now. Now, pay attention. Do you like that? Do you like it?
So-so.
So-so. So-so. Okay. Do you like that? Do you like that? No. Were you able to catch your dislike? You can? Good. Okay. Now I'm going to strike again. Don't jump. Okay. Okay. As soon as the sound stops, if your dislike continues in your mind, watch the thoughts of dislike going on and see how far it is going and see whether it tapers off or not. All right? Okay? Again. Can you detect your dislike in your mind? Is this still going on?
No.
No. But if it is somebody that you really hate and you can't stand.
I can see how it would. A big story and a big trip about it.
Exactly. Yeah. There'll be a big drama,
right?
If it is somebody who's yelling at you instead of the bell, okay, how would you feel? How would you react?
Angry.
Yes, there'll be. You probably passed this right-hand side and onto the left-hand side already, right? And so I'm not going to talk about the other side. That's too difficult at this. We're just going to talk about the milder states, the softer states. So your dislike and dislikes, are you aware of it throughout the day? Yeah? But how do you deal with it? How do you let go of your likes and dislikes?
By catching it.
Caffeine. Were you able to catch it? Pardon?
I said caffeine.
Oh, gosh. I got to the right ground, I think. That's why Starbucks is so doing so well. Right? Well, yeah, the mind that is watching doesn't need caffeine. When it is sensitive enough, it will catch your likes and dislikes quite quickly. And somebody said you can let go, you can drop it. Can you? Sometimes. What about other times? When there's clinging. Very good. Okay. And so when there's clinging, what happens to your likes and dislikes? It's stronger and stronger. Until what? It changes into something else, right?
Stress.
Yes. And it can also translate into speech and behavior, isn't it? Don't you blurt out things sometimes? And so what we are trying to show here is that you can catch your likes and dislikes quite early on. And you can let it be. Okay. The important thing is that you don't act on your likes and dislikes. It has a life of its own if you don't prolong it by clinging. Yes? Is that true?
Yeah.
Any emotion, any thought is impermanent, like everything else, unless we cling to it, we hold on to it, consciously or unconsciously. So this practice is about to become more conscious, more aware of how your inner states function, play out in your daily life. Okay. And the practice is to train the mind, to turn your mind inwards. Actually, what I was doing just now was helping you to, directing you to turn your mind inwards while you're with your eyes open. You want to try again?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, here, dislike. Can you turn your mind inwards and look at the dislike? Can you?
Yeah.
Can you let it be and not interfere with it? Can you? See how it goes. It will taper off. If you don't interfere with it, if you don't engage in your dislike, Okay, the most important point here is engagement. If you don't engage in your liking or disliking, it will die its natural death. Because every state is impermanent. Every mind state is impermanent. Unless you prolong its lifespan by clinging to it, by creating this Broadway drama, right? Then it becomes, it can overflow into speech and behavior. So that's one way we can exit the cycle of conditioning, exit the cycle of suffering or stress. Okay. Now, that's one way to do it. You also see that some of your mind states will be neutral. And neutral here is not really permanent, too. It can move either way. So if you notice that your mind is quite neutral about things, you'll notice also that your neutrality might change any minute, depending on the circumstances. Now, now we're going to go to the second practice, which is to watch our, to detect or discern our value judgments in our everyday life. Now, that is going to be a very interesting thing to look at. Can we exist in the world without value judgments? What do you think? Hmm? No? Are you sure?
Depends on the world. In the monastery.
Oh, monasteries are big places for value judgments. I can assure you. Well, I don't mean to be cynical. But there are some of my Burmese friends, abbots would say, don't think that because I'm a monk that I don't have all these problems. Yeah. Okay, now we are going to go on to look at how we intensify. Okay, before that, I'm going to go to another clip. Now, we're going to describe how we come to have value judgments in our everyday life. What do you see here? It's a little apple. It's a big apple, right? But don't tell me I love that little worm because it's so beautiful. But if it is where black or rotting, I might not like it, right? Right? Then that's also based on my value judgment, right? Because it's, you know, Roger made a little green little, you know. But anyway. What? Yeah, it's cute. That's a value judgment. I had a student who said, oh, I don't like rotten apple, because he said, when I was little, I didn't know, and he bit into an apple that was rotten, and there was a worm in it. Yeah, so his value judgment was, oh, it's terrible.
Okay.
Pardon?
Apple worm?
Half a worm. Maybe. Yeah, whatever. And so in my classroom, we are an old apple orchard, old apple ranch, so we have plenty of apples. And so for my class, I asked a student to bring a rotting apple, and it went around the room. And this is what the values came up from that class. When they looked at an apple that was really rotten, the first person said, oh, it's bad, it's a bad apple. And the second person said, oh, it makes me feel that I will get sick with such a rotten, because she had some fungus infection in her lungs. So the first thing she thinks of is, it's going to make me sick. You see how our filters of the same object differs from person to person and over time. And somebody said, oh, it's going to be wasted. Another person said, oh, it's because people are lazy, they are not taking care of the apples. Okay. So you see all the filters that we project, you know, on a simple little apple. If it is complex, it's even worse, right? Mm-hmm. You've had 8 years of whatever. Didn't you have a lot of value judgments before Obama came in? Now, don't let me start it. I shouldn't have started that. That's big time value judgments. You know. And sometimes I use that in class, and heaven help them, they, you know, they go bonkers over it. And so, you see, depending on our past experience or the present experience, we set up these filters in our, the way we look at objects, people, animals, animate, inanimate, environment, you know, events, world events, local events, whatever it is. So, and all these value judgments are mostly based on greed, ill will, and delusion. But sometimes they're also based on wisdom. If it is based on wisdom, of course, or insight and understanding, then, of course, it's a good value judgment. Like somebody would say, oh, I can still use that. I can cut off the rotten part and eat it. Or another person will say, oh, I can compost it. Okay. And so it depends on how your filter, how you use your filters. And so from here, we're going to look at how it translates into our cycle. Yeah. When our value, depending on our value judgments, whatever that we feel that there's good value, we like the experience, or whatever that you dislike, you know, you go into resentment, anger, hatred, etc. So the filters here on the sensations, these senses, all right, the filters here determine how we react to any experience in our life, okay? That creates all these negative reactions and negative behavior, negative speech. And so this practice is about how to detect or discern what's happening in us that's detrimental to ourselves and to others. Okay? And so in the practice, before we go into how to look at these states, now I want to show you a clip on how these value judgments happen in us. You know, in Taoism, there's a saying that whenever there's beauty, there's already ugliness. Whenever there's tall, there's already short. Whenever there's good, there's already evil. So it's in the same spectrum in your mind. You know, when you say she's beautiful, anything that's opposite to that person will be ugly, isn't it? You already set up a framework that is opposite to it. And that's how we create duality in our mind. And we cling to these two extremes, you either or. Okay? And so that's how we cannot let go of our value judgments because of our attachment to it. And so how do we transcend this, okay, in our practice in mindfulness? Then how do we transcend these values? Some would say, oh, find the middle point. I would say not the middle. You can also get stuck in the middle too, isn't it? You try to find the exact middle point between ugliness and beauty, you get stuck in the middle also. The important thing here is to transcend, to go beyond both extremes, okay? To override both good and bad, beauty and ugliness. And what you will be left with is seeing things as they are or as it is. Right? Isn't it a very popular, you know, saying nowadays to regard things as they are? Isn't it?
Yeah.
Don't you say it all the time? But pardon?
What do you mean by that?
Okay, we'll come to it. This lady is, you've got to sit up front. She'll pose very good questions, I'm sure. This is how you see things as they are. you see that it's a rotten apple, just a rotten apple. Nothing more, nothing less. It's purely a rotting apple. Right? And this is seeing things as they are. And it means that you can see things as they are, which means in Buddhism, equanimity or upekkha. As soon as you have filter saying that, oh, yuck, this is a horrible apple, then you have already set up a filter, a value. And it's hard to see things as they are then. Can you see Hitler as he is, he was? Now, of course, that's the toughest thing. But that's exactly the challenge, is to be able to see people, things, animals, you know, inanimate as they are. Why?
Then when do you ever speak up about injustice then, if you're just like, well, it's unjust, that's just the way it is?
You can still be equal. Yeah, equanimity does not mean it's a passive acceptance. It is acceptance with wisdom. And wisdom will lead you to act. Right? It will lead you to act or not to act. You remember how Obama, during September, when he didn't react right away? You remember that stint? Now, that's exactly what he was doing, was he was looking at things to see what is happening first. And when he needed to act, he acted. When he didn't need to act, he didn't act. Okay. It is important to have wisdom. Right? True equanimity does not mean passivity. It means a silence in the innermost part of your mind that allows wisdom to arise. And it is through wisdom that a person will act or not act. And if it is led by wisdom, it's hardly that people go wrong, right? When you react through passion, what happens? Passion means a lot of anxiety, a lot of anxiousness, a lot of fears, a lot of clinging, a lot of greed. And if passion can have wisdom, that's, of course, will be the best. If passion doesn't have wisdom, then it will lead to chaos, okay, to more detrimental situations. Okay. So this is about practicing, developing the quality of equanimity in the mind. Okay. Which in Buddhism is called upekkha. It means seeing and accepting things as they are, or seeing things as facts. And so in one of our classes that my students would say, they were trying to separate between facts and emotions. And they really got it. See? And so this is what the practice leads to, is to separate between facts and emotional states, especially negative emotional states, so that we can see things, people as they are, without ill will, without greed, and without delusion. Now let me go back one slide here. You see, zero. I love this American way of grading everything from 0 to 10. So I'm adopting that. That's my Americanization, I think. Yeah. So 0, I suppose that's neutral. Dislike, 1. Annoyance, 3. Resentment, 5. Anger, 7. Then it's anger is uncontrollable already, right? Then it moves to hatred and obsession, etc. The same way for liking, you start out with neutral, then move on to liking, 1, desire as 3, 5 is greed, craving, 7 becomes attachment, and 10, obsession, etc. And so you see, it is the same reaction, same emotion, same thought, but it gets intensified as we become more and more unaware of it happening in us. When we are totally insensitive to our mind of what's happening, when we are not aware of what's happening in our minds, you see, this is how our emotions intensify, because we are not intervening, we are just letting it on its roll. And so, you see, craving and attachment, this is the hardest part. When you have gone to that stage, it's very hard to stop. Here too, at seven, like, you know, resentment, you can maybe containable anger, you're already about to explode. And so that's why we want to deal with our emotional states way before it becomes unmanageable. And so the best way would be to handle it at one or three or even five, so that by the time you are able to be practicing on mindfulness, attention on these mental states, your practice also will mature. Okay? Your concentration will get better. Your mindfulness will become stronger, so that at some point, after a long some time of practice, you'll be able to even handle anger, okay, and even hatred. Okay. So it depends on how well the person has practiced and the practice has established in their minds. Okay. Now I'm going to go to another slide. We have to go back to the cycle of conditioning. Now the third practice, this is the second practice I was talking about, watching your value judgment, and then learning to accept things as they are. The third practice is watching your clinging or attachment. And of course is that easy? No. One cue that I tell my students is, you try to watch your clinging, and if it doesn't go away for three times, it's like the three strike. If it doesn't go away after three strike, then you know that you're clinging. If your resentment doesn't go away after three times that you have watched it, or your dislike is not going away after three times, then that shows that there is clinging. Okay? And clinging is just an intensification of your likes and dislikes, resentments and desires, etc. But it is harder to discern because it can be very subtle. You may not be able to see your attachment. You'll only be able to discern your anger, your resentment, or annoyance, or fears, etc. Some of the emotions will be so strong that you will not be able to discern the attachment underneath. See? So in that case, I would tell my students, okay, go beyond your emotional states and you'll see a very subtle attachment or clinging underneath it. Okay. Once you see your attachment, the trick is, once you see your attachment will be no more. See, there's a great talk about letting go. Is it easy to let go? No. You know why? It's quite simple. Because letting go is the result of not clinging. Am I making myself clear? You cannot work on a result. You can only work on a cause, right? And the cause, the letting go is the result of not clinging. If you see clinging as it is and you can let the clinging be and the clinging dissolves, the letting go happens at the same time like this. There's no difference between letting go and acceptance and letting go. Okay. It's just one click. Okay. That's why you cannot practice on letting go. The more you try, the more you cannot let go. Isn't it true? You know why? Because the desire to let go itself is looms bigger than the letting go. So you are again into that loop of don't like it, I don't like it, I want it to exit, and you can go back into the cycle. Okay. Yeah, I have all the secrets. But it takes years and years to practice them. Okay, so these three are the way we practice in daily life. And in Buddhism, we describe clinging as the intensification of craving. And there are three ways that the Buddha talked about craving. Your craving of all senses, everything in this sensual world, okay, including wives, children, you know, the movie, the trees, the wonderful sunset. I mean, everything good and bad we cling to, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Nothing. What else to cling outside the sensory world? Okay. But then there are also attachment to power, ideas, and concepts, doctrines, okay, political doctrines, you know, social doctrines, religious doctrine. We cling to everything else in this world. And then there's also cling attachment or craving for life itself, or clinging to existence and clinging to non-existence. Clinging to existence is your own life. Clinging to non-existence is people who want to reject life. I won't go into details of that. So what we want to talk about is how to deal with the attachments that is so hard for us to deal with. For example, especially parents, isn't it hard to let go of their children when they go to college, or they get married, or they move away? You know, they try to become adults, and you don't want them to grow up, right? Yeah. Now, every moment of attachment that we have, it always leads to some level of suffering. And so, in this practice, what we is helping us is that. In Buddhism, we talk about the three roots of suffering, which is greed, ill will, and delusion. I'm sure Jack and all the other teachers would have talked about that, right? Yeah. These are always potentials in the subconscious. And through contact, you know, we then start to judge, to like, dislike, cling. And it proliferates into all these emotional states here, like a tree, right? And so what I liken this is like a rotten tree, because I know, well, this is a green California. You can't say you want to chop off a tree. So I changed my version. So this is a rotten tree. Otherwise, I'd be branded as very un-Buddhist. Okay, so here, in our practice, instead of trying to deal with every little branch and leaves out there from the ramifications of your mind, we try to deal with the intermediate states before your thoughts and emotions proliferate into anxiety, restlessness, you know, unhappiness, jealousy, fears, obsession, etc. So we try to deal with it at this level, which I call this is an intermediate level before it proliferates, okay, into a big tree of emotions. And so this, there is an approach to this, and it's very well planned, and it has a validity because it can be repeated. You see, every person who practices this will find that it does stop the proliferation of the emotional states, so that it can be validated and it can be repeated. So that's where it is. Now I have I'm almost done. Now this will be the last slide and then we'll be done. Now this is when you have exited that cycle of suffering. This is the new cycle that you will be experiencing. Through contact with your five senses, six senses, there's cognition, there's objective discrimination, you still have pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, but your perception, value judgment, will be cleaner, okay, without ill will, greed, and delusion. With you will have more wisdom. And what you're practicing is mindfulness with equanimity. What you're developing is equanimity. And from equanimity, when the mind is very clean and pure, wisdom arises. From wisdom arises right understanding, right view. Then there's right thinking, which will be non-grasping, non-ill will. And the cycle will go and go. And then it will translate into speech and action. You have right action, right livelihood, right speech, which in Buddhism is the Noble Eightfold Path, right? So you'll be happy forever. Hopefully. Well, that's the end, end point. And then that's where you hit Nibbana. And so this is a wisdom path. See, once the transcendent wisdom arises in the mind, it brings with it loving kindness, generosity, equanimity, joy, which in Buddhism we call the four sublime states. And so this is what in daily life we can change, transform our way of being through this practice and become a better person, hopefully, a person who has more equanimity, who is more in harmony with themselves and with harmony with others. Okay. So it's already 9 o'clock, and so I have only 10 minutes for you to ask questions. So I will have two questions, but please make it short and sweet. Okay.
I don't need the mic.
Okay.
Where do preferences come into play here?
What do you mean, preferences?
Preferences.
Oh, preferences, likes and dislikes.
Now, does it... Here's the second part of the question. I've experienced having a preference where there's a neutral mind and there's awareness of wisdom of what's going on and not judgment and not valuing. And then preferences when I've got something else going on with an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Are both equal territory for collapse into delusion, or one more than the other?
It's hard. It's a hypothetical question. Okay, but what is important is arising of equanimity and wisdom. When that arises, your preference will just fall apart and you'll just be with it as it is. Right? Okay, another question. Yes?
I have a couple quick ones. This wouldn't be in conflict with a sitting practice, I wouldn't think.
No, because it comes out of the sitting practice.
It could come out of,
yeah.
Okay. And the other question was, what about an internal perception such as physical pain? Would that disapply the same way?
Oh, yes, the same way. If you can just watch your pain, that's why I was already also leading when I was instructing, if there's discomfort, just watch your discomfort without likes, dislikes, without the same thing, without value judgments, without clinging to your dislike of pain. Then pain itself is only a physical phenomena, and it also has impermanence, quality of impermanence in it, right? Unless it is something like cancer or neurological implications where it goes on forever. Other kinds of discomfort always has an end to it, all right? Yes? Now, this is a question always posed to me in every lecture that I've given. Passion is such a big thing with Americans, right? Can you live without passion?
No.
No. No. Why? Why?
Because it drives you. It motivates you. It drives you.
Which direction?
Which direction? The right direction,
either way. Pardon? It can go either way, right? But how do you know it's the right direction?
Wisdom.
Yes, wisdom. Again, we go back to the wisdom factor. You can, if you have passion without wisdom, then what?
Chaos.
Yeah, you have a problem there. Right. The Buddha said, a person with compassion but without wisdom is a soft-hearted fool. And a person with a lot of intelligence but without compassion is a very hard-hearted intellectual. So you need the balance of both, compassion and wisdom, or passion with wisdom. If you have wisdom, your compassion or passion will not go overboard. You'll be able to contain the passion to a practical level, to a pragmatic level, right? Just one more. Oh, we still have 3 minutes. Okay. Oh, the gentleman first.
So what is the sequitur into wisdom?
Can you explain what sequitur is?
What leads into wisdom?
Oh, thank you. That's really the most important critical point. The mind has to be absolutely pure and silent. Absolutely nothing in the mind. Then only wisdom arises. There's a portal for the wisdom to arise. It's through the internal silence. And in daily life, we cannot practice concentration, create samadhi like in your sitting. You know, you try to practice samadhi concentration while you're driving. God forbid, if there is a God. Well, anyway, I love that word anyway. I'm a true Buddhist, you see. Yeah. And the most important thing is that we try in the daily life, we try to develop equanimity. Equanimity is a factor that clears out all these defilements, ill will, greed, etc. Because this is the way to transcend these defilements. Okay? So equanimity will lead to clear out the mind. And samadhi, there is some level of concentration when you turn your mind inwards. There is what is called momentary samadhi. The samadhi grounds the mind in the moment. Even when you're in a very heated state, if you turn inwards, it's grounding. Not as much as in the sitting, but it does have some element of grounding. So the grounding will help you stabilize the mind. Equanimity will wave away all these defilements. And wisdom will cut through delusion. So equanimity is a major factor that allows wisdom to arise, or even enlightenment to happen. If in the tradition of Vipassana tradition, some of you may have read what they call the 10 insights, Vipassana insights. The last insight is equanimity insight, just before enlightenment. It is that important. Okay. So in daily life practice, we don't concentrate on samadhi or concentration. We concentrate on developing equanimity. That's why it is a totally different approach from the sitting practice. Although the discipline is derived from the sitting practice, we still use the four foundations of mindfulness. I think it's already time. I'm really sorry. I think we have to break up. Okay, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. There's an announcement to be made.